This is Samuel Adams, March 23rd, 1991. Fathers, tape 2 of 3.
Now I'd like to focus down on father-daughter relationship. And what I'm going to say to you about the father-daughter relationship not only picks up on and extends some of the themes that have been introduced so far this morning, but in particular takes what is essentially a psychological account into the area of physical and social behavior and implications. Because as those of you who came to my lecture last night will know, for me, these kinds of issues have to happen, have to be looked at in an out there sphere, which is understood as being as valuable as an inside here sphere. I want to talk about the father-daughter relationship in terms of its capacity to foster or to harm the development of psychological pluralism in the daughter. I'll explain as I go along what all this means. If you open any glossy women's magazine, such as Cosmopolitan, these days, you will find in it a lifestyle profile, usually of a famous person. And these famous people are very important because they're the mythic figures of the day. She will talk to the interviewer about the balancing act she has to perform. And the balancing act is a very important image within the world that they juggle with. Now, what are the components of the balancing act as revealed to us by famous women in lifestyle interviews in Boston? She has to be a mother, a wife, a star. She has to develop psychologically as well as, or in spite of, all those other things. She even has her raunchy and lusty side. So what she's talking about to the interviewer, who is usually horrifically sympathetic, is her struggle to be many women, mother, wife, film star, individuating female, sex form, and so on, and at the same time be one woman. Be many women and be one woman. Now, clinically, you hear about this in a less elevated or glossy way all damn time. It's the contemporary issue for women, and indeed it's becoming a contemporary issue for men as well. How to be many people and one person at the same time. How to enjoy the plenitude of life that is open to a woman, even in a restricted and patriarchal culture. And at the same time feel a coherent sense of identity as one woman. Many women, one woman. Now, it's a political issue because being many women and one woman at the same time means that you require of the society that you live in that it facilitate your manyness without denying you your right to oneness at the same time. And the world in which we live basically doesn't do that. Although, this is the interesting thing, some women manage it better than others. And this isn't because they're richer or have more pliant and valuable husbands. I think it has something to do with what they have taken in their early years and beyond on their relationship with the father. So what I'm saying is that the capacity to live at ease with and be productive in spite of the tension between knowing who you are as one person with a coherent identity and knowing who you are as many people with different identities, different social roles, different behaviors, different psychologies, and own roles. That seems to me to be a really important issue. Now, how does the father contribute to the daughter's capacity to manage this? And by the way, I'm not talking about the father making it possible for a daughter to be a successful career woman, a good mother, a dedicated mother, an individuated woman. I'm not talking about the father liberating her to be any of those things. I'm only talking about one enormously important thing. The father has a hand in the development of her capacity to do one and many things at the same time. It's a very, very precise point I'm making. I'm not saying the father makes female business like me. Okay? I'm not saying that the father makes for a terrific sex artist. I'm not saying that the father makes for dedicated, sensitive, and happy mother. What I am saying is that the father-daughter relationship, in a way I'm going to explain, makes for this one terribly important psychological capacity to be all of those different and competing things and still be yourself. There's a very, very precise point I'm making with enormous contemporary relevance. I want to stress this again and again and again. The father is not the source of economic and social power for women. The father is the source of the possibility that a woman can have economic and social power and still live at ease with her non-economic work as a mother. So it's about combining. Successful or less successful, combining the issue. And as I said, men have got the same problem. But remember, my idea about the filter. If there's a cultural theme that's much more active for one particular dyad, in this case, father-daughter, then although the same theme may be relevant for other relationships, you can't really get there except going to the one that's more prominent. So, a man has also to be one man and many men at the same time. But we know less about it. We know much more about the woman's struggle to do this. And that's why I keep this within the father-daughter, but remembering there's a metaphorical dimension, and this is going to be true probably of all other relationships. All other relationships do have their part to play in this combining problem. Now, how does it work? From the very earliest weeks and months of life, a father can communicate to his daughter via the agency of his body. Remember, I stressed father's body. Father communicates via the agency of his body a markedly sexual message, which is that you, my daughter, are a potential sex partner. You can call this eroticism, you can call this affirmation, you can call it as Jungian kinship libido. Whatever you call it, you can't leave out the genital. It isn't acted out. Yes. Because I think, if you bear with me, my account of how psychological growth works probably has to be something in there. I just don't see how the basic pattern couldn't be learned. I think the details would vary. So that the father is communicating a certain kind of sexual message. Now, when you have, let's say, and wants to say this is something to do with the heart, not the sex organs, or if this man is completely raving children, remember this. In the book that Jung wrote, when he broke with Freud, which we now know as Sigmund Transformation, one in five of the collected works, he never says incestuous sexuality is irrelevant to psychological growth. He just says it's a question of how you understand it. See? He never says sex is important. He just says it's a question of whether you interpret it literally, as Freud seemed to do then, or metaphorically, symbolically, as Jung was doing. So that, in fact, there's really a very strong connection here between this idea that there's a physical message that's rather important from the beginning of life, the life of the daughter, that's given to her from her father, by the father. There's a connection between that idea and Jung's work, The Symbol of Transformation, about kinship libido. Now, what does this message consist of? And I say, it is a sexual message, but not an inactive one. It's very physical, and it involves a certain degree of arousal in both parties. What does the message consist of? As I say, it's something to do with, you are a viable adult sex partner woman someday. The significance of the message is that the father is saying to his daughter, and he's saying, he's doing it with his body in relation to her body, and she's probably in the first weeks of life. He's saying, in some way, to her, I see in you something other than a mother. Now, this is what I mean when I say the father is subversive, because to say to your body, to a female who's just born, that actually you're not restricted in my mind to the role of mother, it's quite a subversive thing to do in a culture which tends to restrict women in that way. When the father says to the daughter, you are not restricted in my mind to mother, he is subverting a tyrannical cultural equation that says woman equals mother and is mother. The erotic or even sexual factor here is what signifies that she's more than one thing. In other words, it's the second possibility for her. The first possibility is to be a mother. It's like her own mother. And when children have been older, they're very sensitive to those possibilities. Girls, to be a mother. The second possibility is to be a viable, erotic and sexual partner. Now, once you've got two possibilities, you've broken a single-strand equation into three things. Once you've got two, you could have three, you could have four, you could have five. So what I'm trying to get at is that the erotic communication from the father, I'll explain more what I mean by erotic, but I've actually got this part of this. The erotic communication from the father is a kind of gateway to the problem of combining different roles that I stated at the beginning as being the major contemporary issue for women. Do you see how the two things are together? If you've got to work out how to be all those different things and still be a woman, you've got to get a message from somebody, somewhere, that you are a multiple person and one person at the same time. And what I'm saying is you get that if you're a girl from your dad, you get it very physically, and you get it in the first form of, you're not a mother. So that sexuality plays the role it's always played, actually, in promoting psychological growth. But the way I'm understanding it, it promotes one rather special kind of psychological growth. Let me put you a question, and I'll answer it, and then I'll pause and see where we are with this. What is it that enables one person to be an active, supportive player in another person's internal life? I mean, just take childhood, or think of any relationship you like. What is it that enables a person, even the analyst here, to start to operate within another person's internal world? Because that is actually what psychological growth between people is about. You relate to somebody very intensively. It's a very important relationship. You take it inside you. We call it internalization, or and you find yourself growing and changing psychologically inside because of what's happening between you and the other person outside. I mean, it's a, you know, Jung referred to this, by the way, as the hidden mystery of life. He said the hidden mystery of life is always hidden between two. The mystery of life, rather, is always hidden between two. So what we've got to try and work out is, what is it that makes this extraordinary process work? The answer in one word is sexuality. Now, before you panic, let me explain what I mean. What I mean is this. If two people excite one another, take that as literally or as metaphorically as you like, any two people, then they cannot ignore one another. Think about the symbolism of the sex act for the moment. For example, as expressed in the Rosarium Philosophorum, the alchemical stuff that Jung has brought to our attention.
interpenetration, intercourse, people getting into each other's internal spaces.
It's symbolism of sex. And my point is,
you can't just have the symbolism of sex and have a bit of sex too. Or rather, what is the point of turning away from incest, as Jung says we must, and indeed we must,
if there's no real incest drive or feeling to turn away from, to joke?
You can't have your spiritual transformation away from sexuality, the rhythms of sexuality to start with. But I'm less concerned with spiritual transformation.
I'm more concerned with relationships here. So what I'm trying to say is that sexuality guarantees that two people get into a psychologically interpenetrating intercourse state.
And if they get into that intercourse state, then one of them, or either of them,
can be actively assisting in the psychological growth of the other.
And that's what I see happening between the father of whatever sex and the daughter of whatever sex.
But where it is father-daughter, I think it's a special aspect of psychological growth.
How to be more than a mother.
Once you're more than a mother, the list of what you could be is potentially endless, although drastically limited by the society you live in. Let me just anticipate a problem. Why do I go on about incestuous sexuality?
Firstly, I do it to confront us with the point that's already come up about nurturing sexuality.
Secondly, I do it because actually there's no point in beating around the bush. This is connected with incest,
as Jung knew,
but not with actual incest, with symbolic variants of that kind of sexuality. You might say, why do I go on about it and not say eroticism?
I used to be very careful, again, might be the Jung has for stuff about his father. I used to be, because I can do that kind of logic chopping and stuff very well.
No, this isn't sexual, this is erotic, and the differences are six differences between the sexual and the erotic.
It's bullshit.
The sexual is involved in the erotic. After all, both Freud and Jung, throughout their lives, continue to use the erotic word for eros in a sexual way. As late as 1947, Jung refers to the erotic in terms of the simple human sexuality. Freud, on the other hand, uses a word, eros, to describe something about the life instincts and about sexuality, which is linked to
the eros of the philosophers and poets, which brings the world into greater and greater harmony.
So both of them are working out in their own minds this extraordinary connection between genital sexuality and psychological growth.
And this is, of course, what Jungians so often duck in their clinical work.
The Freudians duck the opposite. Jungians duck that you can't de-implicate, you can't forget about the genitals.
They're there.
The Freudians, of course, miss the metaphor completely and interpret it in all too literal bodily way. Now, what I'm trying to do is keep these two things going as best I can. So, pulling it together, what I'm saying is there is a sexual communication which I call
erotic playback. And that sexual communication
from father to daughter signifies to the daughter a rather important contemporary political message, which is, you are not just going to be a mother.
Hopefully the father doesn't downgrade on it.
He may, but hopefully he doesn't. But the crucial thing for us is, what gets started is the idea that she can be more than one person,
but remain a single appearance. Individual human being at the same time.
And that's why I call it pluralism, psychological pluralism, because not because
plural is pluralism,
but pluralism is about the relations between the many and the one.
Many women and one woman.
Now, I shall need to make one more point before I stop.
We are quite rightly these days concentrating on
erotic and sexual excess, child sexual abuse. There is far more of it than we realize.
Every country in the world is reporting the same thing.
And I'm part of that too. I work with abused individuals. But we haven't really focused enough on the other kind of child sexual abuse, which results from what I would call an erotic deficit,
not from an erotic excess.
See, if a father doesn't communicate this to his daughter, father would ever say to them, the daughter would ever say. If that doesn't happen, then that's damaging to her psychological growth. In a different way from the way in which actual incest is damaging, but it's damaging nonetheless, and we ignore it. We are trawling the field of erotic excess at the moment, and we are right to do that, but a result of that is that we are ignoring the consequences of erotic deficit. At the height of one of the big child sexual abuse scandals in Britain a couple of years ago, my next-door neighbour told me that he was now frightened to cuddle his 2-year-old daughter in public. Now, my point is not just that there's individual damage to individual women done by fathers who don't communicate a sense of their erotic viability. There's also political and cultural damage being done because, you see, if you don't give an optimal erotic message to your daughter as a father, then what you're failing to do is give her the message that she can be many women and one woman, and therefore you're depriving her of her political mobility. You are disenfranchising her when you do not give her enough erotic playback. You are disenfranchising her politically when you fail her psychologically for whatever reason and don't deliver an optimum dosage of eroticism in the relationship. You with it?
Yeah, any questions? No? No questions?
Yes. You mean How many times a week?
That is not just a bad taste joke. There is a real issue here. It is just, this is nowhere put down in the question, but I'm glad you know this. People start to talk about this. Because just as you cannot say that the times of sexual relationship never define frequency, so you can't really say what to find optimally wrong in the relationship with father and daughter. It's something in the quality of communication. Words fail one here. Why? Because it's pre-verbal. I mean, later on, adolescence, for example, I think you can start to see some of the things that might contribute to erotic deficit. For example, fathers who completely ignore their daughter's sexuality, or their mother, or they're excessively prohibited, or they just keep away from it, even mothers who are less. Then I think you can start to see, but I think it's much more interesting, although more difficult, to keep this to the very, very first weeks, months, years of life. Because actually, we don't know, we shrinks don't know anything about the early direct relationship with fathers and children. My attempts to figure this out are a very halting beginning. There is hardly anything about, at this kind of level of idea, there are generalities about, you know, fathers should be involved, fathers should be warm, and so on, but I mean, that's fine. But what I'm saying is a little more detail than that. So, there's no prescription. What I would say in answer to your question is this. A father who delivers erotic behavior is by no means always identical with a nice guy. And this is something that the new fathers, the new men who become fathers, really have to take on board. Because one knows of numerous, if not innumerable, women who have had erotic playback at an optimal kind of level from their fathers, and they know that their fathers were horrible. Now, it doesn't work automatically the way either, that a horrible father is one who's providing erotic playback. I'm not saying anything ridiculous as that. What I'm saying is that this is not to do with Mr. Nice Guy, with Mr. Gentle Father. Here, by the way, going off on Bly at the beginning, is where I intended to bring in my tribute to Bly's record. I think he's understood that point. But this kind of delivery of a certain sort of message from the father to the daughter is not equivalent with empathy, nurturance, sensitivity, and the like. What is it? It's very hard to say what it is, but what it says. The key to understanding what I'm getting at is somewhere buried in Jung, where I really am still a young woman. Jung understood something about sexuality as a vehicle of psychological growth. Sexuality as that which brings people into a certain kind of connection. What I'm doing is making that much more precise and saying a certain kind of outcome can be talked about here, and that outcome is being one and being many. That enormous important associated.
In terms of ideas, so it's a big, so it's a big,
turn your confidence.
It's brutal.
Yeah, he talks about this in terms of sexuality.
Well, you know what Lacan says. Desire is desire.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, especially when you're talking about. The daughter's desire is consummated by the father's desire. The daughter's desire for herself is somehow brought into focus.
Well, I was sort of, it sounded like you were talking about desire.
I personally, I don't even like Jung's theory.
Is that a
claim? Oh, absolutely. I think this, but I mean, no, that's not fair. But what I mean is that one's got to be awfully careful to use, not to use a word that takes us away from the body.
It does
make
the body.
It's
talking about the body.
Yes. I prefer desire, yes, and more. But I still prefer desire to be more affirmation or affirmation. I'm quite happy
with the idea that it is sexuality, and that actually this sexuality is expressed via completely normal incest fantasy.
Just to give that to you back. I don't think you even realise what you're saying. Therefore, he admitted to put the freaking kind of miasma. Rage and aggression against God. So it's a very unclear book. And you know, my 5-line summary of that book is all about, it's all about the role of sexuality in general and incestuous sexuality in particular in psychological and cultural growth. And in a sense, it did do what you're hoping to do. It corrected all the thoughts of state. The problem is it's written in such a totally incomprehensible style. It's clearly, so clearly bad. And now we know, by the way, these others. Because Miss Frank Miller is supposed to be a pseudonym, right? Miss Frank Miller is supposed to be a pseudonym, supposed to be a completely crazy lady, supposed never to have had any contact with foreign cultures, turns out to be Miss Frank Miller, born near Boston, by profession lecturer on exotic cultures. Costume performances of readings about Siberian, Far Eastern, Latin American, and North American Indian myths. Jung lied. 100% lied. Because once you know that, that book does rather difficult to take the book as a whole. You wouldn't know this. I mean, I'm doing a very shocking thing by revealing this. But Miss Frank Miller was Miss Frank Miller, not a pseudonym, was not crazy, and did not lead a life where she was completely isolated from all that archetypal stuff. She performed on the American stage for 10 years. Yeah. So, okay, I've just shocked faces around this room. So, okay, but the point therefore is you'd better take my version of Volume 5 than yours. Okay? No. The crucial thing to understand is he basically takes, I can't possibly summarize it, take issue with Freud over the literalism of Freud's understanding of incestuous fantasy. Freud very crudely says children want to fuck with their parents, parents want to fuck with children. Jung says no, there is sexuality in family, but what it's designed to do is to get parents and children into a certain kind of relation. Now Jung talks about how the child, the individual, regresses to meet the parents as kind of grounds of his being and refueling and grow back. So what I'm doing though is picking up on sexuality. And Jung doesn't deny sexuality actually, he doesn't bother with that. He's more interested in big directed images. I'm more interested in the vehicle. And the vehicle is sexuality. And of course, you must understand. And although I say the genitals are implicated in psychological growth, you must realise for me by now, that's both metaphorical and literal at the same time. So it is difficult to summarise. You know, but basically what he's doing there is disputing Freud's understanding of incest. See, incest fantasy and incest, children start from about the age of two and a half to three, talking about marrying or having babies with their parents. Not always of the opposite sex, by the way. They just start doing it. Why do they do it? I mean, it doesn't just start when they become able to verbalise. That would be ridiculous. to think that only when a baby, when a child actually says, "Daddy, can I marry you?" that's when it's beginning. That's when they can put it into words. But what is the baby equivalent? Let's be really provocative. The newborn baby girl's equivalent of, "Daddy, I want to marry you." Think about it. I'm saying there is an equivalent. And I'm saying that the father can better enjoy that and get involved in that. That's why I call it playback, by the way. To imply that it does actually start in the daughter. It's not something he puts into her. It's something he plays back to her, like this machine will play back what's been put. You know? The father is the cassette recorder. The daughter is the original sound source. See what I'm... Yes? Yes? A whole bunch of terms which are to do, very, very shrewd point, a whole bunch of terms that in psychological theory are to do with the mother need to be sort of looked at from a different kind of perspective. What does paternal mirroring look like? Well, those of you who are familiar with the works of Wilfred Bion, what does paternal reverie look like? What is paternal, and then something that has been written about is differences between paternal and maternal play styles. Yes, it is a kind of mirroring, but let us not forget that there are lots of different tones in this, because you see, I'm making a bundle of cultural points. I'm saying, if we're looking at incest and child sexual abuse, let's not forget this kind of deficit on the incest fantasy level. But I'm also saying that somewhere out of this area of incestuous sexuality comes a socioeconomic point, a political point, a power point. If a woman knows she can be many things, then she's in a different political place from a woman who's stuck in one, or is in fact doing many different things, but very uncomfortably. And it's the latter that most people do. Very few women today are stuck in one person. But very few, equally, are happy with the multiple personhood, the community of persons that inhabits. And I'm saying that that is what the father-daughter relationship addresses. Yes?
Something that when we had our daughter, that I could only kind of whisper to other males who both had sons and daughters at 13 and 30, that there was something different right away in that relationship, and we kind of wondered if we were somewhat perverted because there was a different connection or even the word seductiveness kind of thing. But I could never say that in front of my mom. You know, you just, because you feel, well, it's got to be coming from me, you know, that difference in quality, but there is a difference in quality.
Yeah, but don't forget, we're talking about the daughter of whatever sex. So that means that some of you can have fathers too. I mean, remember, I'm doing this, I'm organizing this conventionally because I don't want the cheap solution of just saying, oh, anyone can do anything. I mean, in a way, I do think anyone can do anything. But what I think is that it depends on which kind of anyone you are, how you do anything. In other words, while I'm sure that women can give erotic playback to their daughters, and this account of it that I'm giving is valid. But not in every detail, there are going to be some differences. This is yet to be worked out, and I don't count it. Therefore, to take your point, fathers have to give some of the payback to their sons, but it's probably going to be somewhat different than the way in which they give it to their daughters, as you found. All I'm saying is, you can't even begin to talk about how you give a lot of payback to your son. You can't reflect at least 5 minutes on how you give it to your daughter, because heterosexuality is the world we're born into, and the language is. Absolutely. Every possible, surely by now you've gathered, every possible relationship.
I live.
Yes.
I mean,
sorry. No, okay. You live, absolutely. And I found in my work with single parents, they knew about this. All of them knew about this. Another trouble was, it was still about this. And if you, for example, this is a very common thing in the West Indian community in England, if you are deserted when you fall pregnant, then you've got to give the erotic playback that the father would have given to that baby in the first days. And I believe this does, you see, this is what it's so hard to get into the theory. I believe this does start damn, damn early. And that it is actually something that is somewhat separate from kind of mother-child relationship. Now, I don't want to get into a kind of, is it mother that's more important than it is father? Although that, again, you must have gathered by now.
I really accept that.
But it does begin very. Let me tell you about some fascinating research. Have you heard of John Bowlby? His work on attachment separation.
Well, his theory was that how a child related to their mother, the quality of that relationship,
would determine all kinds of things about that child, like their success at school, capacity to make relationships, and so on and so on. Now, the Bowlbyites are so obsessed with the mother that until very recently, they have never done any research about the father. And I've been teasing them, going to their conferences in Tavistock in London, and say, but you know, what, test this out. Because if you're right, the quality of the child's relationship to the father ought to be able to be predicted by your testing out of the quality of the child's relationship to the mother. Isn't it? And they tested it. You know, they found that, thank God, from my point of view, their point of view would be difficult to take on board if they're honest people and now we're trying to sort this one out. Maybe the research wasn't right. Who knows? But what they found in this pilot study, which is quite large, is that you cannot predict the quality of the father-child relationship from the mother-child relationship. It clearly is following its own path. Now, what's so fascinating about this is that there's nowhere in the literature is that stated. And anyone here who's done a training as a therapist, a counselor, an analyst will know that they've never had that put to them. Absolutely not. You may have been lucky enough to find one teacher or be taught by me, but by and large, people do not get that put to them. And this research, when it's finally written up, is going to be, I'm not a great believer in research, but it's going to be really, really quite interesting. But the father-child relationship is following its own trajectory. It is not dependent on the mother-child relationship. It must mean, therefore, it had its own beginning in some way, right? It begins in the father's reverie about the fetus. That's not a particularly shocking thing to say, but that's where it begins.
I'm still having an issue with optimal body classes, because in a Sunday, I see something with the language that because it's framed in front of a legal language, it has a form how much form it is. But I don't hear in the language any particular message that would either show me or give me an opinion of what would be the optimal relationship. And as I speak, I realize that it's easier to talk about these younger, you know, first few months. And I realize that some of the energy that I have to ask questions is the fact that I have a tendency. Which tends to complicate what optimal body message is. And so, instead of talking about the kind of a charge,
any father who's a daughter will know that when the daughter gets into bed in the morning, given what he wants to do, one of the relationships. Yeah, what do you do? Just to give between the legs, just leave the bed. But I found myself doing nothing, but then in my heart,
women know about this too,
because you all got turned on during pregnancy, childbirth, and breastfeeding. Yes? So this is not something that only men are turned on. But there's a certain, as I say, I think partly because men have it. For them, it becomes a kind of political message. Oh, yes, you're right. You're right. It's kind of the language. But remember, everything I said in the first part of this talk, father's body, stuff to the father, stuff to the father. I want, maybe I need, but I want to do it in this somewhat non-elevated, non-realistic book, non-new age language. Because I think what happens when you start speaking other languages is just you miss the body.
The part of the language is
exactly.
I think he's slightly misunderstood. Actually, what the best thing you said is speaking my language is the particular example of being in that movement of action in the upper. That meaning, to understand what would be an optimal thing to do in a situation like that speaks more to me than to say that I need to have an optimal.
And again, would it help if I read your little case narrative of mine? It shows how this comes through the adult. That might also
sort of clean. I mean, look, don't misunderstand me when I say this.
I've been tracking this stuff around for a long time. I know now that I must stay with this genital incest libidinal language, because I know that that is the way to make to produce the highest possible chance. The overall what I'm saying gets hurt. Okay, it also means that a significant proportion of people who are sitting up here at all, to which it's not you, which means that I lose a few people. Because I actually do not want people in this event to clean this up. Okay, let me get on with the case. This is an adolescent, so could anyone have adolescent people to it? Probably one adolescent. Well, it starts at 10. Okay, well listen, but the one thing you need to know about this case is that in it I discuss something I call gender certainty and gender confusion. Now, the reason why I discuss those things is that too much gender certainty stops the balancing act that I referred to earlier from happening. If you're a woman and you know exactly what a woman is, and she's just a woman, you'll never get into all the other range of possibilities. You need to be a little bit confused about what a woman is in order to enjoy the range. Yes? He's absolutely right. That's why female aggressive and perverted fantasy is clinically not always a pathological sign, provided again it's fantasy. Because what the woman is doing is exploring the bounds of being a woman. Isn't that political? If you're actually thinking, what can I do and still be a woman? You know? Okay, maybe. Am I still a woman if I want to have sex in chains? Am I still a woman if I want to have sex with another woman? Am I still a woman if I don't want to have sex at all? Yeah? All these things can be put into... Remember last night, the same thing in relation to Shakespeare. Absolutely, that's what happens. Well, the sad results of incestuous excess and the sad results of incestuous excess are the same, which is that the woman cannot bear the compliment of being anything and one thing at the same time. And one of the things that happens is if you look at the vocational side of women being sexually abused as children, is that they have distinct discomfort about the inadequacy of their lives. There is an achievement point, a good point, around achievement. Now, my take on that is that a lot of excess from the father, too much a lot of the paper, has paralyzed them into one, basically into one of the things. But nevertheless, what they lose is the capacity to live with the conflict between their many selves and their one self. Yes.
Yes, I'm using social roles. I'm using social roles because I want to make an important professional point here that social roles are the responsibility of that sector.
So let me do the case and you see. This is about somebody who I've called Margaret. And Margaret was 18 when she came to see me. She turned up for our introductory meeting exactly 1 week early. And the next day, her mother telephoned to ask what had happened at the session, because later that evening, Margaret had taken an overdose. I mean, I was working with somebody else, and the doorbell rang, and I picked up the entry phone and said, yes. And she said, it's Margaret. And she'd come a week early.
Well, it does happen sometimes. So I had to send her away because I was with the other patient. So I literally only had a very brief conversation on the antidote saying that your appointment was next week. I was worried, but what could I do? So she managed to communicate a desperation, which clearly got worse when she was overdose. Awful beginning. And then the mother ringing me up saying, what do you want to do? But the point is, I'd done something. Yeah, but look, if you think about it, you know, I'm talking about erotic playback, okay? Here's a case where the only content I was able to do was on the phone. I mean, that's symbolic. I want you to think of that symbolic thinking, you know? I don't blame myself. For the moment. Margaret was the second youngest of four children, and her mother had had some experience of Jungian analysis that she put to good use by interpreting her children's dreams for them and in other so-called professional ways. She reinvented herself as the analyst of her children. Working with Margaret, I was struck by how often it was her mother's opinions that were being voiced. Above all, her mother's view, as relayed to me by Margaret, was that motherhood is the acme of womanhood. So you see, the womanhood is mother thing was being carried in this family by the mother. Margaret was apparently a real worry and a failure because of her lack of interest in things maternal, in babies in general, and in her younger brother in particular. We could say that Margaret knew for sure what a woman was supposed to be. She knew. She was talking in the equation. Woman equals mother. And out of that gender certainty, she judged herself harshly. Now, the father, what I want to know about, the father was described by Margaret as an alcoholic who became violent. He was said to be completely in awe of his wife and to regard the children as their and as her domain. His attitude to Margaret's education was that it, quote, should fit her for marriage. In general, he was dismissive and disapproving of Margaret. I think it made truly the mother image held sway in his family. Margaret's ambition, this is 18-year-old boy, was to be a writer. She wanted to be, she could see that she wanted to be a writer. But she couldn't fit that desire, to be a writer, into a scale of values in which motherhood was at the summit. For Margaret, it was either be a writer or be a mother. Isn't that familiar? Even yourselves, the women here, and the men too, either orness of what to do, how to prioritize time, all the jargon we use, you know, my time. So the mother, I want my time. But for Margaret, it was either be a writer or be a mother. Now, there were all kinds of attempts to denigrate motherhood. I think she was trying to make herself feel less inferior. She had fantasies of being a boy. In her dreams, there was a lot of hostility towards the mother. Now, because of my conventional training, it took me a very long time to understand why and how, for Margaret, aggression against the mother was a kind of way ahead. She had to find from herself, but she didn't get it from her father, the wherewithal to break up the equation. So instead of the equation being broken up by an erotic contact with the father, the equation had to be broken up by aggressive imagery in relation to the mother. And she had a dream. This is the dream. The whole family, including my father, was on holiday. It might have been in Venice, for there were small canals and white pavements and glass shops. One night, my elder brother murdered Mummy and my younger brother in their beds. Mummy was stabbed first, and then my younger brother, who was lying next to her. I was so upset, I went shopping in an American supermarket, crying really loudly, not knowing how to contain my grief. I tried to pay for some chewing gum that I'd bought, but I saw the packet being half-eaten. I tried to fill it up from other packets. The man said to me, "It's good to cry." Whole family's on holiday in Venice. The elder brother murders the mother and the younger brother. She was so upset she went shopping in an American supermarket. Crying really loudly, not knowing how to contain my grief. She tries to pay for chewing gum, but the packet's been half eaten. She tries to fill it up from other packets. And the man says, "It's good to cry." Now, we discussed this dream in terms of her freedom when disguised as her brother in dream to slay the mother and the whole mother trip. It didn't feel right to us to limit our understanding just to aggression against the personal mother. We've got the point by now. Penny had dropped. Now, she commented that it was very odd that she didn't simply buy a full packet of gum as a replacement. It was obviously something very special about that packet. She associated this with being stuck with who she basically was in outline, but perhaps new contents were possible. See, stuck is a... Do you know that song who does your chewing gum loses favour on the bedpost overnight?
What do you do with chewing gum? You stick.
So for her association was a punning association. Chewing gum has something about being stuck with who you are. But somehow she can put new bits into the packet. You see how it connects somehow with being one person, packet, with new things being added? Is she stuck, or is she going to have new elements in her personality? Well, then Samuels, in his clod-hopping, stupid, patriarchal, psychodynamic way, said that I noticed that it was chewing gum she was eating, that chewing gum isn't nutritious to her mother in her. To which she responded that chewing gum was vital for her concentration whilst writing. Why do you always talk about food, she said, when I want to talk about work? I mean, obviously, no example should fit every detail of the theory. If it does, don't believe it. It's made up. That's not made up. So it doesn't fit every detail. But you can see she just got no erotic playback at all. But she was engaging, without me giving her a theoretical lecture, she was engaging with this one person, many person. I'd take a couple more questions, and then we'll do one experiential exercise. Particularly questions people haven't asked questions yet. There, they do. Yes.
I just
can't. Do you have a question for that?
Well, I have a situation. I'm really interested in trying to get when you are and I'm thinking about a mother who is son who is being told I was talking to the doctor she was not feeling her in the usual sort of internal way. I mean, she was doing a lot of neurotic and pretty stealthy things to tell her in terms of that, talking to her about what it felt, you know, and being very pleased with her.
That's Charles.
Yes, that's, so there's some boundaries, but that's not what you mean.
No. What I do mean is the phrase you used. Ordinary, it wasn't ordinary maternal diaper.
But see, that often means the mother is screaming out her own awareness of the sexuality.
The point is, I'm not requiring mothers or fathers particularly to do anything, basically my peroration, I mean, an hour earlier. But I actually don't think that anybody has to do anything different. You see, this is what I was trying to say last night as well. We are in the consciousness business. Fathers have always been delivering optimal erotic playback to their daughters. It's always been potentially available for social and political purposes. The only difference I'm making is I'm raising it above that threshold. You know, saying what it's very difficult to say. So this is the point. You don't have to do anything other than ordinary. But you see, once you interpret ordinary maternal diapering as including an erotic playback element, we interpret it. You do it. The mother does it. We interpret it. That's the game we're in. Once our interpretation includes the erotic, it, in a way, it affects what she's doing. And this is a beyond the Cartesian split way of understanding it. Our interpretation, our text, the text we form about erotic playback being part of normal maternal diapering is a revolutionary or new element in the situation. You can't put anything new in. You can only get a new understanding.
Yes. Yeah.
yes. Fantasy about him as a sexual being, and that she might turn those attention in slightly different ways if that's what was happening in his mind, rather than
absolutely.
Being totally unaware.
Yeah, that's right. But I would use the other way around. It's not in, I mean, that kind of maternal reverie is fairly well known, even if you're going to be, etc. It's the other way. It's knowing. It's knowing and inwardly responding affirmatively to the sexual impact of the baby on yourself. That's the point. That's why it's erotic playback.
Yes,
all right.
That's what I
okay.
think you mean. Right. But I'm just
so the son's penis, let's get right down to it, the son's penis is asking to be responded to by the mother in a certain kind of way. She doesn't have to tickle it erect. It's got a life of it. It doesn't need that kind of help. Yes? What it does need is to have its message played back. And its method, mirroring is quite good, important mirroring. It's a kind of paternal mirroring, provided we understand paternal as referring to the father of whatever
sex.
All
right, so would you then, if the mother is mirroring, would you really need to reflect the same question?
Well, I think, first of all, by definition, if she's mirroring something that's already there. Now, in other words, the capacity to be a pluralistic person, to have a pluralistic psychology, that is to be one person and many people at the same time, I mean, and be able to do the problem with that, that capacity is obviously an innate capacity of human beings. Men have been given the social conditions for that to flourish. Women have.
I understand what you mean. How would a woman be a mother's behavior be recognized, mirroring her child? What would she be doing or saying?
It cannot be listed.
But you can just hold an image.
Well, everything is in how the child perceives it. For example, is my penis acceptable? Am I succeeding in turning her on? Does she run from my sexuality? That would be the thing. Or does she, and this is the point why erotic playback has to be understood as something first and foremost affecting fathers and daughters, but then affecting wider relationships. Does she understand that I am more than just a helpless baby?
How do you imagine you would get the message?
I'm not answerable. First of all, the point is that you're asking for me to produce some desiderate, you're asking me to be a Dr. Spock. And I, oh yes you are.
No. Oh, I agree, I get the feeling that someone wants like a sheep, five things.
Yes, that's what I'm hearing.
And I say, no, let me say this. In C.S. Lewis, he writes about teasing, and what's the difference between mean teasing?
Well,
where the boundary is, where transgressing.
No, I think that takes it far too conventional. It seems to me that we're talking about a bodily message and looking for its analog in words. Now, I'm wondering whether that is in principle. Possible. Yes, you're going berserk here.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm just having the feeling maybe it will help me. So it seems to me what you're talking about is an energy field that's created in this consciousness. And it is happening. That's what I mean.
Yes,
the consciousness and the interactions. I mean, in the mother's standards, it's not social, it's in the mother's standards. And the communication is created in energy.
Why let's keep the father in mind too. I'm going to slip into the usual thing that happens.
The father.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yes. Who lives?
I'm very, very, very reluctant because of my whole background is to say what the signs of this would be. I can only do it in terms of an adult with adult psychology and psychopathology. Now, so that this is my best shot at this, is that a woman who cannot cope with the stress of the conflict between being one woman and many women, in my view, is likely to be suffering from an a deficit of erotic playback. And a woman who can cope with that kind of multiplicity and still remain unified being has probably had optimal erotic playback. So in the end, I have to do this like an analyst, not a child or psychology specialist. And this is the nature of the problem. I have to do it from a retrospective point of view. I can't do what you want. I could. I probably could do what you want.
But I think you misunderstand.
Okay, well, how do we go to this?
I don't think that this is but I mean, because different mothers will certainly have their own experiences on the men's side. But it depends on about how one might like to feel about it.
You talk about it, but just one step removed, actually, can you talk to me about a situation where I'm changing baby's diaper? What kinds of things, what kinds of biases might I represent?
Well, I don't understand what the problem is with sin. I think I've said it before. I've talked about
kinship libido, incestuous fantasy, wanting to marry, have babies with, recognizing the erotic viability of this person when they become an adult, understanding that they're not just a lover, but they're a sexual being, and what more. I think there's I really do think this is an adequate list.
Yes, absolutely.
It's my best shot.
But I do want to point out that we've got back to the mother because.
Yeah, I know, but also because maternal stuff is easier than paternal when we're talking about incestuous sexuality. Yes. Sorry.
It seems that what you can say. Is that there's two things you shouldn't do, and one is to, because it is easier to go with the mother than the rat. One is to beat it with a stick, and the other thing is to stroke it. In other words, either one is not a mirror, but either one gives that.
But you see, take mirroring as a general thing.
What does one do to a very small infant to mirror that thing? Okay? One simply does ordinary, devoted, good enough parenting. There isn't anything else. This is what you're having trouble with. But what there is new in this, and I hope there's something a teeny bit new in this, or even a weeny bit new in this, is how you read it. Is how you read what you already know about. Yes, you've been trying for ages.
I've been really trying to provide some knowledge. Play with me. I come from a male point of view, but the rule is the function of verification is different.
Let me take on two of your stories. You've got a 10-year-old daughter, you've got a 26-year-old son. How do you react when either of them, when one of you speaks, first said, "Mummy or Daddy, can I marry you? I want to marry you. I want to have a baby with you. Or let's play baby and let's actually begin. Let's play mummy and baby or daddy and baby." Or if it didn't happen, how did you feel then about it not? Because you must have known it happened other times. Have to develop. In other words, if you want phenomenology, give us phenomenology. Okay? I've got ideas.
No, right.
We're assuming, let's start from the assumption that you today have had a developer of playback. So does your answer to this be the answer to your question too? Unless what you want to say is didn't
you? No. In answer to this question, I would say that, first of all, I find it useful to start with this, so I have lots of opportunities to experience that happening. So, by the time that my child, my daughter, is doing that, she has to be speaking, so we're always talking about what I did at the second grade. There is no problem. You just play.
But then you have to see, you have to notice that these other couples, you know, they're not relevant to this community. But if you want to set up a little house here, you know, maybe you can set up this little house and I'll play with the husband.
That's right.
Whatever. So you allow the spirit to achieve the most sexual part. That's not the point. That's what you mean by living.
But you see, the point is not in the narrative. The point is in the interpretation. What I'm saying is, let's assume that the narrative is starting. What I'm saying is that what you did there was subversive, and you were like a patriarch. Because by going with it, what you said to her was, you are not, you know, I don't just see you as going to be a mother and a mother. Although, even in early game, was, I mean, it was a sex moment. You don't have babies without sex. Then have sex unless you want something. So you were already opening up the field. Yeah, that's the point. So here's what I'm doing. I'm taking that tiny little bit of normal interaction between the family, father and daughter, during the house. Okay? And I'm saying that's really revolutionary. Revolutionary if I'm just putting it in a revolutionary way. Sally, what about yours?
I felt the same way around here.
Did you listen?
Andrew, if I could throw in one last thing. What I'm experiencing, and I think it's fine, I'm ready to move on too, but I'm experiencing a learning style. You know, you're very theoretical and presumably a thinking type. I'm a feeler, and I feel better with a particular example of the theoretical thing. I think that's the one thing.
Maybe, although I don't know how to relate to this to me, I think it's about your handbag level or something like that. But I wonder, I'll give you an example from my own family, and then I want you to do it at length inside, and then we'll, then perhaps we'll have lunch. Is that okay? Because I think, I don't know, I mean, I am a theorist, but I'm not sure how excuse to be this fair being. Okay. This is a little story, okay? I call this story, You Be the Daddy, Daddy. You be the daddy, daddy, said my two-year-old daughter as she plonked two dolls, two rabbits, and a mouse on the floor between us. She thereby became the mummy, and as well, mummy with a capital. Not just the mummy in the game, but mummy because I'm mummy. I'm daddy with a capital. We have kids, she's mummy with a capital. Later, when the plastic and furry kids had been put to bed, though long before the departure of the flesh and blood child, I fell to musing about you be the daddy. Clearly, I am her daddy and have to be addressed as daddy. But what differences and similarities are there between daddy with a capital B and daddy with a small b? It appeared as the game went on that other people than daddy with a capital B can be daddy with a small b. Well, she also said, I'll be the daddy. The father of whatever sex and age. I wondered if this second statement, I'll be the daddy, daddy, was an example of somebody becoming the father of whatever sex or age. But even the command, you be the daddy, daddy, throws up numerous possibilities. Perhaps she meant that I should be the father on an impersonal or non-personal level. Not the daddy she knew with a capital D, but the daddy with a small d, which we can gain. Not daddy as daddy, but someone whose name just happens to be daddy, playing daddy. That would be a human being drawing on the archetypally sanctioned possibility of being a daddy. Then I thought of conventional psychodynamic explanations. She's two, she's recently out of diapers. She was able to project her regressive fantasies and longings into the play children, which would clean them up. Fed them from breast and bottle and generally babied them. And of course, if I'm the daddy, she could be the mummy and her wife. Or she could have been identifying with me, her daddy, and the daddy in the game as a way of keeping me inside herself during a time of developmental transition.
or she might have been testing that the man she calls daddy really is a daddy. And what about the tensions between the competing statements? I'll be the daddy, and you be the daddy. She's nearly three. A formal psychological language in which to express... That's why I'm not sure I can do it. A formal psychological language in which to express discoveries that come from playing with children and one's own children doesn't exist. The psychological discovery that I was making in this game, and in others before and since, upturned the apple cart of social reality. Though I didn't actually think up the idea of the value of confusion during this game, it is in the fluid, dramatic, rough and tumble of play, with daughter and son, that the idea has developed and been fleshed out. For these games, which are all familiar, have a definite social and political impact. Subversive children transform the political viewpoint of their reactionary father. You be the daddy. You have to imagine the sentence on the page. You be the daddy with a small d, comma, daddy. So what we're talking about here is a radical reinterpretation of what everybody, even Freud and Jung, is going through. Now, pushing it a bit because lunch is expected, I would like to do an exercise that will really a physical exercise that will flesh out some of this stuff. I'd like you to form into pairs. Just stand up. Face each other for the moment. Now, can you see me? This is a very, very simple exercise. Basically, you go to the side of your partner. Okay, you just stand loosely like that. Keep close, keep it, okay? Make any decisions about what's going on. Place your hand in the small of your partner's back. And without exerting much force, lift them up and forward, like that. These are all kinds of options as to how to do it. You go back, forward, nice, nasty, frightening, up and forward. Up and forward. No, we don't have three times. Just walk around. Is that a
okay?
Okay, I'll do it with you. I'll come.
Yeah.
Okay, so please start. Okay. Did you all have a chance to read that poem? Is anybody not going to copy of it? Okay, well, that's a slight problem. Two of you didn't get a copy.
Who was the poet?
Who is the poet? What do you think?
You.
A poem, yes.
So it has to be someone
equal. Yes. Have fun. Yes.
Yes, yes. Well, we have been talking, have we not, about the father of whatever sex. By woman. Without patience, mother. And I think it's rather, kind of a little trick to say, from a man's point of view, but by a woman. I think now, if you read again, you'll probably see that there are certain sentiments expressed that perhaps you are give the game away or reveal it to like you.
The roses brought to her when she gave birth.
Yes. Yes. She remembered it.
But she did it.
She forgot. Ready for me? Very
loud. Say it from a woman's point of view. Okay. A woman would want roses brought to her because she gave birth.
Oh, I see.
But that's not necessarily true.
Yes.
My mother-in-law said
it. But who, did any of you suspect it was by a woman?
No, but that's kind of reassuring. I thought if a man wrote this, he's way out in the field and write a creepy, like, they might have talked to his mother or daughter.
Is there anybody who has a counter view with that that actually focuses allowing for its sugary, somewhat high school version of style? Anyone who thought actually this is not a bad expression of what sounds good to
is that?
Yes? Anyone else? Do we touch it? Yes? Yeah. I think it's a very important thing to do. I'm sorry to, you know, play a trick like that.
You're not sorry.
You fixed your
head. May I make an observation? The error, and this may be the first child, is that the parenting stops in the time.
Yes.
Because that's not true.
No, no. But that isn't specific to the writer being male.
Well, there is that possible that all is mother, but it's not part of that necessarily.
Well, in that case, given that she's a woman, she's a good mother.
No, she's a
so I don't. Well, it's kind of, but the question is, are we looking at this as are we looking at this literally? In other words, now you know it's by me, or are we looking at it in the terms of well, the fact that you cannot, that I cannot understand what you're saying, is the point of the workshop part. See what I mean? I don't know whether she's right or not right, but I don't know whether you mean you're assessing her as a woman or as a man.
No, I wasn't assessing it. Obviously, I made the observation. I still assume that it's real.
Yeah, well, that's her as father wondering, as every father has when with the daughter, does the daughter know that the father is a man? Does, you know, in other words, do you know I'm different from your mother? If you want to take a really down-to-earth view of this, yes, she's pretending. Just like Shakespeare was pretending. What he wrote about in his past. She's pretending.
Well, that's part of
the experience.
Is it a woman imaginably trying to write from a father's point of view, or is she writing of her experience in that father's way?
I think this is the modern sort of stereotype. Maybe it's somebody who's invisible to tell me that the father or the husband is not over there.
Well, I would say that I must say I would say that let's think of the intelligence which was written. I would say that this father is really engaged in the kind of wrong this morning. But it is, you know, but then gets complicated because we now know this father is in fact the daughter probably writing about something to do with maybe a wish that the father had been like this, who knows? So all I want to do is to put it into the melting pot. Okay? And I have to have it, I have to do it around a break time. That's okay. I've done that. Now we move on to the father-son. But hopefully you're now resensitized to the father of whatever said by the story. Okay. We will finish 3:30. Whatever happens. And I've been asked by several people, where have I written about this stuff? The answer is in this one, which Saul is carrying. There's two chapters in here. Well, there's several chapters in here which go together. One is called A Relation Called Father, which looks at death psychologists theorizing about the father. And one is called The Father of His Children, which touches on everything we were talking about today. There's also a chapter on the alchemical metaphor, which takes some of these ideas about sexuality and the purpose of children. And you may get to also another chapter called Beyond the Feminine Principle, which is my terrific and troublesome onslaught on certain aspects of Jungian feminism. So the whole thing is just basically a fun read. Now, father and son and aggression.
remember,
the idea is that you can't talk about mother-daughter aggression without first looking at it through the filter of father-son aggression, because that's the one our culture knows about. That's what the Oedipus complex, to some extent, is written about. You know, the Oedipus story begins with Oedipus' father casting him out as an infanticidal impulse towards Oedipus, and then you know what happens. But basically, that kind of aggression between father and son seems to me to be the culturally sensitized relationship in which aggression takes place. I want to suggest to you that we know dramatically little, frighteningly little, about the phenomenology of aggression. We know a great deal about the ego defense mechanisms that are brought into play to cope with the anxiety caused by aggression, whether it's aggressive fantasy or aggressive impulses or whatever. Psychoanalytic theory is absolutely packed with that kind of thing. We don't know much about the details of aggression. There's no kind of anatomization of aggression. Now, what I want to do is to share with you some possible ways of really getting into the aggression thing between father and son, because my thesis here is there is something, you won't be surprised to hear, called aggressive playback, which is what the father of whatever sex provides for the son of whatever sex.
You want to play back before lunch?
You want to play back after lunch? If you come back next week, I'll give you spiritual playback. Although this is all spiritual, if you really understand spiritual. How can you chop up aggression? How can you chop up aggression? Well, one way, the way that a lot of social theory do is to make a distinction between aggression being a kind of out-of-control, destructive impulse, essentially antisocial and possibly even sadistic, and aggression meaning healthy self-assertion. So you can take a somewhat judgmental line and say there's aggression that's all right, but it's just healthy self-assertion, it's needed for social life generally, and then you can say there's aggression that's really nasty, sadistic stuff. That's a reasonable way to subdivide aggression. Or you can follow a very simple Freudian style schema of the bodily zones. You can talk about oral aggression, anal aggression, genital aggression. For example, oral aggression would have everything to do with biting, with tearing of teeth, with consumption and greed, and so forth. Anal aggression would have to do with making a mess, smearing wood on top of for other people, shit stirring, as we say. If you say shit stirring, did you say shit stirring? When someone stirs up a problem, stirs up a hornet's nest. Stirring the shit? Starting the shit. Okay, we call it shit stirring. I'm sure you can understand the idiom. It's not so foreign. And other kinds of anal aggressions would be the whole battery of anal retentiveness that we know about, you know? Then there's genital aggression. Now, some examples of genital aggression would be Don Juanism. That's to say, sex without feeling, that is part of an ever-increasing tally of conflicts. So that's aggression towards the people who are the recipient of such sexuality. Mostly men do that, but not only. Women also keep a tally stick. Other aspects of genital aggression would be things like tycoonery, you know? Big cars and first-class seats on airplanes, all that. So these are basically ways of looking at aggression. It's subdivided in the detail of it. Then, for those of you that are at all familiar with Kleinian theory, it doesn't matter if you are or not, there is what people loosely call paranoid schizoid aggression, which means aggression takes place without there being a relationship to contain it. There's a kind of lash-out. Now, one very important aspect of schizoid aggression is that it's very sneaky, you know? It's very, very sneaky. It's a way of doing somebody down without doing it to their face. Nudge, niggle, aggression. It's not in relationships. Then there's, to use her language, Melanie Klein's language, is what they call the depressive position of aggression. It doesn't matter if you know what
what that means is aggression that takes place no matter how violent the impact will be within a related framework. You don't run away from the consequences of your aggression. And any of you will know that aggression rather than those giving it out, but what the difference is. You know, you really feel that someone is aggressing you in a related way. And when someone is aggressing towards you in a schizoid and unrelated way, you often find in the schizoid depression, I can't actually get a handle on what it is that's been done to you aggressively. You know what I mean? Right. So, there's a well-known way, actually, of anatomizing depression. But I've been wondering whether there isn't another way to do it, which would involve a really rather literal anatomization of depression, using the human body, not the zones of the body, but the actual elements of the human body, as indicators for certain kinds of aggression. I mean, for example, there's the aggression of the bear hug. You know? Because the bear hug is a characteristically ambivalent way of expressing aggression. You know how many people meet and they hug? And they, ooh, you see? But that's the kind of thing that you can do. And there's an even now a new modern variant. It's a rather schizoid one. It says, just come into the ambivalence of the bear. It goes like this. Have you seen men doing that to each other?
Yeah.
Terribly, terribly ambivalent. But now look. But now look. Look. Say he's a father and I'm a baby son or a child son. And we're having an argument. Okay? We're having a big, big argument. And you walk away. He's employing their aggression. Okay? Now, watch. I go down like that, and I bear hug his leg, like little boys do, walk away. Now, is this true love? No, because I'm also very cross with him walking away. That's why I'm using the ambivalent one, the chest aggression of the bear hug. So you see, what you can do is you can use the human body to characterize different kinds of aggression just in a non-related, in a situation where there's just one person, in a situation where there are just two adults, like the ambivalence of the bear hug, or you can put it into, this is what I want to do, a father-son framework, and really get quite a deep understanding of the psychology of our father-son relationship. You see, it isn't just that I, as the son, matched his leg aggression with my leg aggression. I mean, that would be bizarre, because he would have run away and I would have run away. That's something to do with your baby son, your child. You use another kind of aggression. And that just seems, again, normal father-son interaction. Now, what's going on? Here's now the rereading of it. Okay? What's going on is that the father-son relationship functions as a place where transformations within aggression. Because the only thing really wrong with aggression is if you get stuck in one style only. In other words, if you're only a bear hugger, or you're only a leg aggression person, or you're only a Don Juan, or you're only a tycoon, or you're only schizoid, or you're only anal, these are problems. You see, this is a very non-linear view, I think a very realistic one. You can't transform aggression into something that isn't aggression. All you can do is transform it within the category called aggression. Do you see what I mean? And this is what fathers and sons do. They work together to keep the aggression moving. So the next time they interact, it might be a different kind of way. They don't get stuck in one style of aggression only. Now this is a very, very important thing. It's a very marked cultural and political ramification. So if we do a little bit of cultural example. In England, you don't have this here, but...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.